Hey, this is Noah Levine, founder of Against the Stream, Refuge Recovery, and Dharma Punks. Thanks for tuning in to the podcast. I hope you're enjoying the Dharma. Together, may we create a positive change on this planet. If you feel moved to leave a donation, there's a link in the show notes. May our paths cross soon. Welcome, everyone. I thought I'd follow up, continuing with this mini series on the heart practices. The Buddha said that his awakening led to compassion for all living beings, a sense of loving kindness, friendliness for all living beings, and appreciation of not only one's own pleasure, but also the happiness, the wholesome sources of success and joy that others experience, sympathetic, that kind of, I think I'll do appreciative joy and talk about joy next week. And then the fourth, Brahma Vihara, divine heart quality, is equanimity, but I thought we'd do equanimity tonight. And just thinking about what that means to you. Maybe you're already well aware of the Buddha's teachings on equanimity. It's not a commonly used word, I don't think. You probably don't often use the term equanimity in your daily life. Maybe you do. If you're hanging around Buddhists enough, maybe you do. I think one kind of simplified way to think about equanimity is keeping your cool, no matter what's happening, sort of being similar to the loving kindness teaching, being at ease, no matter what's happening, not just when life is easy, but also when life is quite difficult, maintaining a sense of equanimity, ease, cool, well-being, understanding and accepting that pain is unavoidable, that we will all experience pain in our lives, and we'll try to meet that with compassion. We did compassion, we did forgiveness the last couple of weeks. And not only accepting our own pain, but also accepting that everyone that we care about will also not be available, not be able to avoid pain in their lives. That nobody, none of us, enlightened, unenlightened, wise, not wise, pain is unavoidable. And, you know, and some levels of suffering for all of us unenlightened people, it just goes with it. And maintaining our cool in the face of other people's suffering, rather than feeling too overwhelmed by the suffering in the world or the suffering of our loved ones. Of course, it's harder with the people that we care about than the people that we can feel. They say that the kind of near enemy of equanimity is indifference. And, you know, so with strangers, it's a little bit easier to feel indifferent. It's not quite the same as equanimity. Equanimity is mixed with compassion, is I care about you, but I also understand that I can't fix you. I care about you, but I also understand that your pain is your responsibility. Your compassion is your responsibility. I can't give that to you. I can't do that for you. And so maintaining that sense of cool and ease and well-being, even when there's so much suffering happening in the world, so much suffering happening probably in our own lives at times, and then in the lives of our loved ones So maybe for the small group, I'd like to start by asking you to talk to each other, maybe identifying the most challenging or some of the challenging places in your life where you find it hard to keep your cool, where you become reactive. You're not equanimous. You're, you know, enraged, or you're, you know, extra passionate. Not, you know, I don't love to use the term passionate, because passion can be such a beautiful thing if it's channeled in the right way, but where you lose your cool, You don't have that ability to maintain a sense of ease within you, and you become reactive. Whether that's reactive in craving for it to be different than it is, or aversion, same thing really, right? Craving and aversion, and that sort of like, it shouldn't be like this. And, you know, in this world where there's war, in this world where there's oppression, in this world where there's all kinds of ignorance happening all of the time, understanding of the Dharma that says, all beings are responsible for their own happiness. We can't actually make anybody else happy, is a core teaching. And I'll talk more about equanimity, but you know, the difference between that and dismissiveness or indifference, and then also not using equanimity to be cold-hearted about what we should be compassionate about, or to say like, everyone's responsible for their own happiness, so I don't have to help, I don't have to be engaged, I don't have to feel compassionate and engaged in compassionate action. So what are some of the places that you find challenging to maintain your cool and keep some level of equanimity? Find a couple people you don't know yet, introduce yourselves to them, discuss keeping your cool. A couple of ways that I think about equanimity in simple terms is, one is, nothing is worth suffering about, which can be hard to swallow. Nothing is worthy of suffering about. That no matter what's happening, we can develop the capacity to meet it with compassion, with acceptance, with understanding, with forgiveness. One of the other ways that talk about it is remembering that happiness or unhappiness is not created by what is happening, but is created by how we respond to what's happening. Equanimity. Our happiness is our own responsibility. This is, you know, kind of, it's a pretty radical Buddhist perspective. It's not about what's happening in the world. It's not about what's happening in your life. It's not even about what's happening in your mind. It's about how we learn to respond more wisely to our minds. How we learn to respond more wisely to pain, to pleasure, to neutrality, to afflictive emotions, to states of pleasure and joy. It's not what's happening. It's how we respond to what's happening. And this is, on some level, it's the only way that Buddhism can actually be true. That the third noble truth of Buddhism, that we can awaken to a place where we respond appropriately in our lives to the joy, to the sorrow, to the reality of ignorance and oppression in the world, to the reality of having a human mind that is critical and judgmental and jealous and has all of these difficult emotions that it tends towards, the human psyche tends towards. It's not what's happening in your mind. It's how you're relating to that and being like, oh, rage is present. And being equanimous with the mind raging, rather than I'm only happy, I'm only at ease when my mind is not being critical, is not being judgmental, is not raging, is not fearing, is not worrying, is not lusting, is not having all of those challenging thoughts and feelings. Happiness or unhappiness is not created by what's happening. And doesn't it sounds radical to me? I know certainly when I started practicing Buddhism, I did not understand that. I was very much convinced that my happiness or my unhappiness 100% was dependent on what was happening at the moment. If it was pleasant, I was happy. If it was unpleasant, I was unhappy. And even if it was pleasant, if it wasn't pleasant enough, no matter how pleasant it, you know, I was pretty sure that it needed to feel better in order for me to feel content, that all elusive contentment. Maybe we could think of equanimity as being content with what is, accepting what is. Because compassion is such a central focus, and because compassion is for all living beings, I mean, there's the self-compassion is so key. We all have to learn to tolerate our own pain, to care about our own pain, to meet our own pain with mercy and compassion. But also it's living in this world where there's so much pain and having compassion for each other and seeing the woundedness and seeing the ignorance and seeing the confusion that creates every form of oppression, every form of violence, every form of war, every form of dishonesty and greed, all coming from a confused being. And so the focus on equanimity in the traditional meditation instruction is very much a training of like, how are we going to respond to the suffering of others? And that tendency, I think I said in the compassion class we did a couple weeks ago, the difference between true compassion, which has no clinging with it, it's just caring. It's not caring with an agenda. It's not caring with an expectation. It's not caring with, I care and I need you to not be in pain anymore. I care about you and it's okay that you're in pain. I know that pain is impermanent. I know that it will come through. Compassion is, I hope that you learn to meet your pain in a wise way, not a delusion that I wish you never experience pain again, because that's not reality. So part of the instruction that we'll do here in a minute is the Buddha saying, remember, everyone has their own karma. Karma meaning responsibility, actions, and the consequences of our actions. And karma is a very empowering understanding. It's saying that we can change how we relate to what's happening. We can change how we act in response to pain and pleasure and joy and sorrow, and change the trajectory. When we meet our pain with hatred, we create hatred. When we meet our pain with compassion, we create a tendency to be more accepting and caring and compassionate. So in the equanimity teaching, the Buddha says, remember, all beings are heirs, the inheritors of their own actions. And their happiness or unhappiness depends on how they act, how they respond to what's happening in their life, not your wishes for them. Encouraging us to have equanimity with the pain of others. Again, it has to be in conjunction with compassion. I care about you. I know I can't fix you. I care about you. I'll support you. I'll encourage you. I'll, try to educate. I'll feed you. I'll try to protect you. All of those things are compassionate. But the equanimity comes in and says, I know that ultimately I can't take away your suffering. I can protect you from violence at times. I can protest against ignorant, violent wars and all of that stuff. But I can't stop anybody from being ignorant and violent. I can only encourage, protest. The Buddha was into protest. The Buddha, many times in his life, went to the front lines of, violent conflicts and spoke about peace and did a nonviolent protest, engaged action. And sometimes it worked and they stopped fighting temporarily. But ultimately, and this, I think for me, it's an important acceptance and equanimity with this world that we live in, samsara, the realm of confusion, the realm of suffering, that even in the Buddha's, towards the end of the Buddha's life, his whole family got wiped out in war and violence. And even though there was this enlightened being walking around, they're still killing each other over greed and resentments and, land grabs. It's happening then, it's happening now. Human empire making is, our history. and it's our present, and it's almost definitely our future. That's what humans do in this realm. But the Buddha, what a great example of out of compassion, he spoke out against it. He did what he could, you know, but he didn't, you know, even having an enlightened being around doesn't end greed, hatred, and delusion for others. Only for those who are willing to train their own hearts and minds, and equanimity being this central part of the training. Remember, everyone has their own karma. Everyone's responsible for their own happiness. Out of compassion, we do whatever we can, but we have to know our limitations. We don't have power over other people's internals. We can't make anybody stop hating. We can't make anybody stop being greedy. We can't make anybody stop being delusional and ignorant. I mean, maybe part of the conversation we can have later is we can hold people accountable. You know, and there is a place for accountability and karma, not just in the law of the, you know, kind of internal karmic, but also, you know, societies need structures and people, you know, accountabilities, and, you know, there's a place for imprisonment. You know, not our modern American industrial prison investment that people, you know, are locking people up in a very unjust way, but there's a place for consequence. We don't want to take equanimity to the level of complacency. Does that intro make enough sense? Do you get a sense of what equanimity is? Balancing compassion with acceptance, understanding that everyone has to do their own work. Their true compassion has no clinging. Often we have to have that humility to say, like, my compassion is often mixed with some sentimentality and some clinging and some craving and some intolerance for the suffering that's happening. Some codependency, some, you know, kind of, I care and I really need you to stop suffering in order for me to be at peace. I need this world to be different than it is in order to be at peace. Is normal. It's not the highest wisdom, but it's the normal way that we walk around, I think, most of us. Okay, so we'll do some sitting meditation. I'll give some instructions, then we'll have some more discussion about equanimity. Settling into the upright posture. Softening, relaxing, releasing any tension that you can release in the brow, the jaw, the throat, the shoulders, the chest, the belly. The clenched jaw is often resistance towards what's happening, the tight belly, aversion. So we try to put our body in the posture of acceptance, accepting this moment just as it is, upright, relaxed, open. Just the practice of sitting still in meditation is developing equanimity. It's saying that, it's embodying that no matter how uncomfortable I get, I'll just tolerate it. I'll be with it. Rather than fidgeting, rather than adjusting the posture too often. Learning to just sit still. accepting whatever sensations arise in the body, whatever emotions and thoughts come through our awareness. In a general way, starting with this reflection on this world that we live in with all of the sorrow and confusion, the 10,000 forms of joy and the 10,000 forms of sorrow. With our strong aspiration towards compassion, towards loving kindness for ourselves, for each other, for our loved ones. Training the heart and mind to be loving and kind, compassionate and forgiving. And balancing the compassionate aspiration with the equanimity understanding, the wise heart that understands happiness and unhappiness in this world are not dependent on what's happening, but how one responds to what's happening. It's not the pain, it's the hatred of pain that causes suffering. Not the pleasure, but it's the craving, the clinging, the addiction to pleasure that causes suffering. Placing the phrase in your heart and mind, all beings have their own karma. The happiness, the unhappiness, the suffering, or the freedom from suffering are not dependent upon my wishes. I can't will anyone else into wisdom. All beings are heirs, inheritors, the owners of their actions, how they respond. taking this into ourselves, reflecting on our happiness, our unhappiness, our joy, our sorrow, all of the ways that we blame circumstances, all of the ways that the mind craves for things to be different than it is, and that fantasy that the mind creates that says, I would be happy if. I will be happy when I get what I want, when life starts to be pleasurable all the time, then I'll be happy. Bringing this reflection on equanimity into your own life, your relationships. Reminding yourself you don't need them to be any different than they are. For you to be at ease in your own skin, in your own heart and mind. Equanimous with our partners, with our friends, with our parents, with our children. This very high bar, high wisdom. It's possible to be at ease. Like the rest of the teachings, it's not something that we can make happen, but it's an aspiration, it's a training, it's part of the goal that we're working towards. May I learn to be equanimous with the reality of my life, taking full responsibility for how I respond, rather than blaming others for my unhappiness. So that it doesn't feel too dry, mix in some compassion. Saying to yourself, I care about you. I care about myself as much as I can, and I take full responsibility for my happiness. I receive the karma of my reactions. Out of compassion, aspiring to be more accepting, more loving, more forgiving. And then directing this equanimity towards someone or some group of people in your life that you very much care about, that you love. Perhaps it's your partner, your close friends, your children, your parents. Those who it's quite hard to see suffer because we care about them so much. And extending some love, kindness, compassion to your near, dear, your loved ones. And then reminding yourself this equanimity phrase, your happiness or unhappiness does not depend upon my wishes for you. You have the ability to free yourself from suffering, to meet your pain with compassion. To let go, to accept yourself just as you are, to be wise. I wish this for you, but I understand that my wishes will not create happiness or wisdom in your life. Reflecting on the other people that you care about, reflecting on the people in this sangha that you meditate with. Each one of us doing what needs to be done to develop some wisdom, some compassion, equanimity. Supporting each other, caring about each other. But understanding that ultimately each one of us fully responsible for our own happiness. Expand to bring to mind somebody that maybe you have some resentment towards, somebody you're working on forgiveness with. Reflecting on this person who's harmed you in some way. The mind resenting, the heart closing to, trying to protect ourselves, reflecting this equanimity perspective upon the difficult person, the difficult people in our life. Your happiness or unhappiness does not depend upon my wishes for you, my anger, my resentment, my ill will. You're the owner of your karma. Can be quite liberating to realize we don't have to continue hating, trying to punish, everyone has their own karma. With this intention to learn to meet all living beings with compassion, with loving kindness, with appreciation, And with this understanding of karma, agency, responsibility, with non-clinging, with acceptance, all living beings responsible for their own happiness, unhappiness. That it's not what's happening, but how we're responding to what's happening. We made it extra cold in here so that you could practice being equanimous with the air conditioning. Sebastian, would you shut it off when you get a minute? It's a really radical perspective that it's possible to be happy in this world. And that it's possible to have compassion for our own pain as well as the pain of each other, of all of each other, all beings, not just the ones that are that we like. And I've found this equanimity teaching so important, so key. Over and over identifying how my compassion is mixed up with some craving for the suffering to stop, the pain to stop, for the ignorance to stop. I have to often remind myself that that's just not what's happening here. In this planet, on this realm, and we call it the Buddhists, we call it samsara. Samsara is a realm of confusion. When you're no longer confused, when you're no longer in ignorance, you don't keep coming back here. This is where the confused people are born, being born onto this planet, this level, samsara, the human realm, is a realm of greed and hatred and delusion. It's the way it is. And I am guilty, and I so am often, you know, in conversation with people who are quite upset about the way this world is and really have that strong feeling that it shouldn't be like this. There shouldn't be racism. There shouldn't be sexism. There shouldn't be homophobia. There shouldn't be wars. There shouldn't be greed, unbridled capitalism, or, you know, all of the things that are happening on this planet. And it's quite easy to get on our, you know, kind of like, yeah, it shouldn't be. Why shouldn't it be? Because it's possible for humans to be wise and compassionate and not greedy and loving and nonviolent, because there's that possibility, that's how it should be. It should be peaceful. It should be equality. It should be, I think so. I think it should be way different than it is. But the, you know, studying Buddhism, looking at what the Buddha, his life and his life of activism and his life of reflecting on these things and his enlightened perspective was, you know, no, that's the way this world always has been, always will be. That there's never going to be peace on earth. It's not what happens on this, in this realm. There's just too much our greed, our survival instinct, our ignorance, it's so hard to develop true compassion. I mean, the hours of meditation that one needs to do to really train the mind to be truly compassionate, the hours, the decades of meditation that we have to do to really be able to practice renunciation around clinging and aversion, it's just rare. Everyone can do it. I mean, there's this Buddhism on some levels is very hopeful, empowering. You know, on one hand, it's saying all living beings have the power, have the potential, have the ability to free themselves from suffering. It's like such a incredibly optimistic, empowering view. All living beings can do this. And then on the other hand, but hardly anybody will. It's an option for all of us to destroy the causes of suffering in our internal heart-mind process through wisdom, through compassion. It's an option. But the reality is, and even in the Buddha, when he was asked, like, well, why? He's like, only a handful in each generation will probably really take this thing to its fruition. Because it's so counter to our instinctual drives, against the stream, against greed, against hatred, against delusion. And our biological evolution is just one of greed, hatred, and delusion. Greed for pleasure, hatred of pain, self-centered delusion. It's not our fault. It's not because we're sinners or evil or anything. It's just that's the way this animal evolution is. But it's confusing, right? Because it doesn't have to be that way. And I can get caught in this of like, but it's possible to be kind. It's possible to be nonviolent. It's possible to be honest. It's possible to renounce unskillful, unethical actions. It's possible. We were driving back today from visiting my mom up in Santa Cruz for the weekend, and my wife and I, Lily, were driving down and talking about somebody that I know that was engaged in an extramarital affair. And she said something kind of half joking of like, see, nobody's trustworthy. But it's easy to like have that perspective of like, wait a minute, why do people cheat on each other? Like, why? It's so possible to not do that. But it's so common to do that, you know, and it's so, so common to do that, unfortunately. And it can start to look like, yeah, people aren't trustworthy. It's hard to find people that have a lot of integrity, a lot of honesty, a lot of authenticity, a lot of, you know, actually living wisdom and not just talking it. Right? You find a lot, you know, hang out with Buddhists, you'll find a whole bunch of people that talk a really good game. And then you find out not as ethical as they've been saying. So that bigger perspective of, I find it helpful to have some equanimity with living in this world with a little bit more expectation. Expectation of ignorance. You know what I'm saying? I encourage all of us, let's flip the script. Rather than expecting people to be ethical and nonviolent and wise, expect people to not be any of those things and be pleasantly surprised. When you meet someone who is loving and wise and honest and ethical and compassionate and forgiving, expect that to be a rare relationship, rather than going into all of your relationships and out into this world expecting everyone to have integrity and ethics and wisdom. Wisdom is rare. True wisdom. Truly ethical, wise, is rare on this planet. It's much more common to find people who are lying and cheating and stealing and self-centered. I, me, mine is the norm. That's normal. Does that help? I don't know. It's kind of a bummer, but I feel like for me, it helps to be like, oh no, I don't, I need to stop expecting people to act right and be pleasantly surprised when people are acting right, are being kind and generous and loving and wise, rather than so shocked when people are not. And this perspective of total personal responsibility, and that we are fully responsible for our own happiness, and that it's not about what's happening. And I know, anybody that feels skeptical of this, I'm with you. And it's easy for the mind to start making up some hypotheticals of if you're in Gaza and, you know, you're being fucking murdered and bombed and your home has been, you can still be happy. It's not about the fact that your house was just destroyed and your family has been killed. It's, you know, you can have compassion and you can be at ease with that. Like, I get the scenario of it's a little hard to swallow that people in war zones also, you know, can learn to respond in a way that they don't suffer about it. Because it just kind of seems like you're in a war zone, you're going to fucking suffer. You're going to be angry and you're going to be hurt and you're going to, you know, so it's a really, really high, probably nearly unattainable level of wisdom to say even in a war zone, even in the midst of some sort of abuse, or you could still, with enough wisdom, be free from suffering about that very painful situation. I know that it's a little unrealistic. It's so high. I feel like when I received these teachings and early recovery from addiction and was quite convinced that all of my problems were everyone else's fault, not in a war zone, just in jail, my street life, I found it very useful to kind of take personal responsibility in this teaching that said my happiness, my unhappiness is going to depend on how I respond, not what happens. So, you know, for a lot of us, it makes a lot of sense. Maybe not for everyone. I don't know. That's something we need to overlay on everybody's situation. In some ways, equanimity is the Buddhist Al-Anon program. It's the Buddhist love without clinging. Like in Al-Anon, you know, if you're related to or in relationship with alcoholics, they say, detach with love, be loving, but don't cling. Don't try to cling and control. And, and so again, this is the Buddhist perspective that says, be compassionate, but also don't be attached to your compassion making other people change. Non-attached compassion, non-clinging love. One of the other teachings from the Buddha that is also about equanimity in our own lives, I think, more than, you know, so some of the way that equanimity is talked about is in our relationships. How do we relate to the suffering of others with equanimity as the intention, non-attachment, seeing they're responsible for their own happiness, out of compassion, engaged in service, engaged in generosity, engaged in supporting, protecting, educating, all of that commitment. And then ultimately, I can't fix you. Nobody could fix us. We can't fix anybody else. And then the there's a teaching called the eight vicissitudes, the eight worldly winds. And this, again, normalizing, teaching that as we walk through our life, you are going to experience these eight things. And the practice is, can I have equanimity with both sides? They're sort of four opposites. And so it's pleasure and pain, always talking about pleasure and pain. Pleasure is impermanent. It's not the source of happiness. Pain is impermanent. It's not the source of unhappiness. It's just pain. Pleasure and pain, these vicissitudes, and all of us, and it's the main conversation and the main practice in Buddhism. How am I relating to my pain? How am I relating to the pain of others? How am I relating to pleasure? Not only the pleasure I'm experiencing, but the lack of pleasure, the craving for pleasure. How much of the time am I worried about not getting what I want, losing what I have? Pleasure and pain, the vicissitudes. And more and more, the way that I started the instructions, just learning to sit still as a practice of equanimity. Whether you're comfortable or uncomfortable, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant to sit here, and doing that every day, sitting still every day and developing more and more tolerance for discomfort, more and more equanimity, whether your mind is peaceful. So many people don't meditate because they have this delusion that meditation is supposed to feel good. And that, like, you know, you've all probably heard it. Maybe some of us have said it of like, well, I can't meditate very good because my mind won't shut up. This, you know, mistaken idea about meditation being calming, peaceful, silent mind. And part of the equanimity is, can I just sit here with my mind sometimes in worry or in grief or in lust or in fear or in raging or fantasizing about revenge or whatever the mind is doing, and having that equanimity with like, oh, unpleasant mind states. Yep. Lots of fear tonight. Lots of anger tonight. Lots of lust sitting here. The mind is watching porn. Yep. Okay. Lots of lust present in the mind, and having equanimity with the human mind. Not the idea that it needs to be calm and quiet in order to be at peace. Being at peace with the tumultuous nature of emotion and thought and sensation. Praise, pleasure and pain, praise and blame. The second two of the eight. And, you know, depending on your conditioning, in general, we tend to think that people like to be praised and appreciated and, and people don't like to be blamed and criticized and judged. But you have to look at your own conditioning, because maybe you're one of those people, or you know some of those people who really have a hard time taking praise. And they find it incredibly unpleasant to be praised, and they feel insecure and so, you know, weird about getting positive attention. So it's where even looking at these vicissitudes, it's not just what's pleasant and what's unpleasant, it's our perception because of the feeling tone of praise. Like, do you like being praised? Do you like being appreciated? Do you like being publicly acknowledged? Or is it way too fucking embarrassing and feels really unpleasant to be too much public attention? In private, it's okay, you know, one-on-one, it's okay if you thank me, but don't go telling everybody. Don't go praising me. Don't fucking post that shit on social media. It's bad for my image. Trying to be a tough guy. Or blame. You know, generally, you know, we would think, well, it's not very nice to be criticized and blamed and seen as somebody that's doing something unskillful or has done something wrong. And it's so hard for us to, for most of us to, you know, just have the humility to be like, yeah, I fucked up. You know, we want to hide it. We feel shame about it. We want to, we don't want to be seen as somebody who, you know, has done something unskillful or fucked up in some ways, be blamed, be criticized. When I was going through a whole bunch of public blaming a few years ago, some of it was true, most of it was actually based on dishonest accusations, but it was really interesting for me where I saw this part of me that after many years of getting a lot of praise for being a teacher and a writer and all of this stuff, mostly getting praise and blame was, you know, occasionally I got some criticism, but mostly I was getting a lot of praise for a long time. And then I started getting a lot of blame, a lot of, you know, and I saw this part of me that was like, oh, you know, this is almost more comfortable. There's part of my mind that heart, whatever it is, conditioning, probably a little bit neurotic, that felt a little bit more comfortable in being the target of criticism than the target of praise. Praise is always a little bit uncomfortable for me, but, and you know, blame's a little bit uncomfortable too, but I just saw that part of my mind, that young part of my mind that was like, see, I am a bad person. That kind of insecurity, that self-hatred from early, early young voice in my life. And that the blame just felt so like, oh yeah, this sort of fits. Being famous and popular and praised all the time, like this isn't fit. But being, you know, accused of being a scoundrel, even though it was mostly not true, still felt like, yeah, this is way more punk. This is way, way more rebellious. I even had a little bit of like, this is sort of off the topic, but I even had a little bit of like some of the people that were, I felt my perception was were really like intentionally causing me a lot of harm out of their greed and their, you know, resentments, whatever it was. I even found that part of me that was like, I was a little bit proud of them. I was like, you really pulled this off. You stole all of this money from our community. You, I just felt like, wow, what a great, it's that sort of like, I love a good, like, you know, con artist movie. Like a good plot of like, wow, you really got away with robbing that bank? That's fucking amazing. And I felt a little bit like that of like, wow, you really got away with doing that? There was that part of me that was like, fucking, you're a gangster. And being able to, you know, have some level of equanimity with all of it, the praise, the blame. The next two are gain and loss. And again, gain, you know, can mostly be seen in the form of like getting what you want. And that part of the mind that says, I'll be happy when I get what I want. When I get the relationship, when I get the money, when I get the job, when I get the stuff. the status, maybe it's the attention when I gain, right? All of those. How often does your mind tell you you'll be happy when you get something? And maybe it's just dinner. Can't wait to get some tacos. You know, I'm going to be stoked when I have some ice cream, when I have some whatever it is. The grass is when I get the, right now is okay, but that's going to be really good. I mean, when I gain that experience. And that idea that happiness exists in some future rather than in the present. That happiness is something that some material or sensual experience is going to give to us. And loss, that unavoidable reality, that everything's impermanent and that everything that we gain, maybe, you know, ultimately everything that we gain, we lose. There's those five daily reflections that the Buddha taught and encouraged. He said, every day, say to yourself, I am of the nature to age. I'm not exempt from aging. I'm of the nature to experience illness, disease. I'm not exempt from illness and diseases. I'm of the nature to die. I'm not exempt from death. Everything that I have will be lost because of death, right? So ultimately, you don't get to take your 64 Impala with you, Sebastian. I got a new motorcycle this weekend, just what I needed, a new motorcycle. And I don't get to keep it temporarily. I traded my hot rod for a motorcycle, and I can remember when I wanted the hot rod. I was like, I need a hot rod. I need a Ford Roadster, you know, somewhere between 30 and 33. It's, you know, I want that. And then I gained it. And I was like, oh, this is awesome. I bought this hot rod. I love this hot rod. And then after a couple of years, I was like, sits in the garage. I'm going to trade it for a 1950 Panhead. That's what I need. I need to gain a Panhead. I need to lose a hot rod. Just that, you know, like it's, you know, material stuff. I mostly relate to my material stuff of like knowing it's not a source of real happiness, but it doesn't stop me from gaining and losing and gaining and losing and trading in this toy for that toy. With some level of that kind of delusion that says, oh, but this is gonna, I'm gonna like this one even better. This toy. Gain and loss. And then, you know, so it's not only the material things, you know, all of our relationships, the impermanent nature of relationships, and that, I don't know how many of you, I mean, probably all of us, I was going to say been married and then divorced, but that idea of like, I'm going to get married and I'm going to be so, it's going to be great, and some delusion of like, and it's going to be forever. And then maybe you find yourself some years down the road of like, oh, that wasn't the right one. Divorce, impermanence, loss, grief, or even if it's not about a relationship, but just life of, you know, losing our loved ones and our, you know, I'm certainly at this age, you know, my mom's online tonight, but she's turning 80 next month, and she hurt herself, and, you know, just seeing that sort of late end of life of our parents. My wife's parents, both, you know, having some stuff around cancer, and just that kind of loss that's happening, that kind of not only the reflection of I'm subject to sickness, aging, and death. It's true for everyone that I care about, all of us in that loss. Process of impermanence and loss. The last two are, and they feel, I don't actually know, I should look into this a little bit more. I don't totally know why, because the last two are fame and disrepute. And I'm not so sure how different from praise and blame that is, but maybe it's more on a public, you know, we're all going to be criticized at sometimes and praised at sometimes, but then fame, like maybe there'll be certain times in your life where you'll be popular, you'll be famous, maybe not on a large worldly scale, but just in your circle or even in your family, you know, like, you know, sometimes in your family where you're like, you're the good one this week. you're the one that succeeded in this way or that way, or in your circle, you know, you're famous this week. And then the kind of the opposite of that, which is like the disrepute, the fall from grace, that you've been put on a pedestal. And inevitably, if you're put on a pedestal, you'll be taken off of that pedestal at some point. And then also, I feel like, you know, praise and blame and fame and disrepute. It's like even the Buddha, kind of think like the enlightened one was fucking famous, right? People must, you know, like you got to like sit with an enlightened being. You have this, it's easy to have this idea of like, wow, like Siddhartha Gautama was an enlightened being. He was in India and people, you know, the stories like, you know, and hundreds of people, thousands of people were coming to see the Buddha. Like he was a fucking rock star to some. And the stories are also that he was despised, criticized, blamed, and really not beloved by most of the culture because he was proposing some really radical teachings like equality, like nonviolence, like non-greed. And a non-theistic approach to awakening that the polytheistic, you know, Vedic Hindu culture was like, wait a minute, you're saying that we, you know, are worshiping our gods and is not necessary. And so he was very much criticized and judged, and there was even a bunch of attacks on the Buddha. So just to kind of end and wrap it up with, the more we can see our lives as these sort of waves of praise and blame and gain and loss and pleasure and pain and fame and disrepute and expect it, the more we can live in this world with its greed and hatred and delusion and ignorance and expect it and accept it, this is the way it is here, the less we suffer about it. The more we're clinging to an idea that this should be a place of love and nonviolence and ethics and equality for all living beings. Of course, that's what compassion, that's the part, you know, that our heart wants that for this world, wants that for our lives, wants that for each other, of course. And it's not what's happening here. And so that equanimity with actually the way it is, acceptance of the way it is, not complacency, not inaction, but that reality, this is the way it is here. And from that foundation of acceptance, what can I do to create a positive change in my life, in my family, in my society, in my subculture, in my relationships? What can I do to create a positive change on this planet, accepting that it's a planet of ignorance? How can I bring more wisdom to this planet of ignorance rather than, I've already said it too many times. Equanimity, both internal and external. One or two questions. Lydia, it looks like your hand has been up for a while. If you want to jump in there, go for it.
Thanks, Noah. I guess just sort of question, I think I've mentioned like a few times in discussion with you about kind of having an ongoing struggle with my dad, who's been a practicing meditator, you know, since before I was born. And And I've been in this period of non-communication with him. And today's actually his birthday. It kind of dawned on me earlier today. And I'm just feeling like a lot of sadness because I don't really know what to do, I think, at this point. I feel like I've tried to do equanimity practice with him and compassion practice. So I guess my question is kind of like, what do we do with the relationships in our lives where it's like to be in communication with the person, it feels like it's sort of enabling like an old behavior pattern and an unhealthy dynamic, but then to be out of communication feels really just painful and also feels like I don't know. It feels like avoidant sometimes. Like I think I just struggle back and forth, and I just kind of lately I've just been feeling at a real loss and not having a clear answer as to like what is wise action and what is wise communication when it comes to this dynamic with this relationship with my dad. So
I mean, I certainly don't know specifically for that dynamic. It is often wise to have really good boundaries, even with our parents when they're unskillful with us and cause us harm. And there's something interesting about boundaries sometimes. Often we think about like to protect ourselves from unskillful, abusive behavior. But also, there's something about sometimes having a boundary, because you might get to the place where you can tolerate somebody's abuse and not take it personal and not even suffer. You might come to the place where you have so much equanimity, you could be around dad and he can't even push your buttons anymore. You might come to that place. You may or may not be there yet. That's okay. But even if we're there and we're in a dynamic where we know this person will be unskillful towards us, there's a compassion perspective that says, I'll still hold that boundary because I don't want to be the source of them creating that negative karma for themselves, even though I could handle it. I could totally tolerate it, but I don't want to put them in this position where they're not able to get out of their reactive tendencies and they're going to create all kinds of negative karma for themselves by the way that they treat me. And so I'm going to avoid allowing them to create that negative karma for themselves out of compassion. Sometimes, which is a whole nother level of when sometimes it's right to hold those boundaries. And sometimes after a period of, good boundary and avoidance of a difficult dynamic, we can re-enter it, kind of put our toe back in the pool and see. Is this still happening? Have I changed enough? Have you changed enough? And sometimes the answer is no, they haven't changed much. But the answer is also actually I've become better boundaries, so I can actually navigate it in a better way, and it has changed some. And then it's up, it's entirely up to you. It's always up to us. Like, do I want to re-engage with this historically unskillful, challenging relationship? Do I feel confident that I can kind of show up in a little bit of a different way? I don't know if I ever told you this, and I'll end here. My father used to talk about what an incredibly challenging relationship he had with his father, and that every time they would fight, and his father would criticize him, and then after some years of his meditation practice, my father had done a bunch of retreats and, was really trying to be this, awakened guy. He went back and was, and his father was criticizing him and saying, you fucking dirty hippie and get a job and all of the stuff that his dad would say to him. And, what's this, Buddhist bullshit? And he was just non-reactive. I was just like, no, Dad, I love you, and I get that you don't understand, these choices that I've made in my life or whatever. And that his mother, my grandmother, was like, wow, I never thought I would live to see the day that you didn't fight back. And that as soon as, and he said, and in that non-reactivity, having that equanimity with the criticism, it diffused grandpa. And then after a while, Grandpa was like, okay, this isn't working. So, Pat's the matzo ball soup. So, you might find that, which doesn't totally fit with what I was saying earlier around like the karma that we're allowing them to create, but you might find that you can come to a place where you're not taking it personal anymore. I said I would end with that, but just before class, I was talking to somebody, and what you said brought it up too, of like having somebody that's a, you said he's got a long-term Buddhist practice, and your dad, right? I find it more difficult when people should know better. I know I've talked a lot tonight about like, yeah, we just got to expect this world to be full of greed, hatred, and delusion. But when you have somebody that's like studied wisdom traditions and practiced them, and then it's sort of, in some way or another preaching them, but then they're really not living, they're not being very ethical or very kind or very, it pushes a button in me for sure of like, wait a minute, you're a Buddhist. You should be more awake than you are. Again, it's our own delusion, though. We have to stop expecting people to be more awake than they are. So we'll leave it there tonight. A couple of announcements. We've got this new sweatshirt that is available. It's an Against the Stream sweatshirt. It says Venice on it. It's got the praying hands. It's got Sebastian 64 and Paula on the back. It's a really cool design. We only had them for sale here in LA, but now they're available on the website. So especially for those of you at home that want to order them, my mom, although she's recovering from her injury, is able to get some things packaged and sent out. Might take a little bit longer than usual, but she is doing the mailings. We do also have some here if anybody wants one of those sweatshirts here. The May retreat, the weekend retreat is sold out. There's a little waiting list. If you didn't register, but you want to come, you could get on the wait list. If there's any cancellations, we'll let a few more people in if there's cancellations. If you're planning, if you registered and you're not going to come, let us know as soon as possible so we can get some of the waiting list people in. The fall Against the Stream retreat, 9 nights, September 24th to October 3rd, I think, something like that, is open for registration. 9-night silent retreat. Really, just the only opportunity this year to go a bit deeper in your practice, to spend, almost 10 days sitting and walking in silence. It's where there's a deeper level of equanimity that we develop, a deeper level of wisdom. When you get, the weekend retreats are great to just taste it, but then to actually get 10 days in retreat is a really beneficial experience. So plan for that, register for that, come to that in the fall. Against the Stream is a nonprofit. We're a donation-based organization. Been doing this Monday night class for about 19 years now, I think, here in, or 18, something like that. Every Monday by donation. The reason that I'm still here, that we have a meditation center all these years later, is because of your generosity. Thank you, all of you who contribute. And please continue to contribute so that we can continue to be here and give as much as you can and as generous as you want to be. Please consider becoming a monthly supporter if you're not already, or you just say, I want to give Against the Stream $25 or $50 or $100 a month, whether or not I'm coming to class. I really like to try to get out of that fee for service mentality of like, I'm paying because I'm going, rather than just I'm supporting this organization because I believe in it. And whether I'm there or not, I want people to be able to go meditate without being charged for it. And everybody's welcome to come. So please think about it that way. Am I forgetting anything?
Yeah, it's good enough.
Good enough? Mm-hmm. It is 5 minutes over. All right. Offering merit outward in all directions to all living beings. May each one of us get as free as possible. And together, may we create a positive change on this planet. Next week, appreciation, joy, and all that happy shit. Thanks for tuning in to the podcast. This is Noah Levine, founder of Against the Stream and Refuge Recovery. If you feel moved to leave a donation, there's a link in the show notes.